Welcome to the Justified Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Justified on FX/Hulu. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Justified City Primeval Season 1, Episode 6, Adios. Aaron, what'd you think of this episode?
What do you say about an episode like this? It's got great dialogue. It moves the plot along. It kills one of my favorite, I don't know if you call them antagonists. You know, the people living at the fringes of the law on Justified. One of my favorites. It's a guy who's just wanting to help out his people, his neighborhood, giving the shirt off his back, giving the car out of his garage, and just wants a little piece of something. And this fucker Clem, who has nothing, takes it all from him. Hard to feel good about it. Hard to feel good about this. Oh, yeah. Also, the idea that, like, there is a bigger bad that is pulling the strings behind. There's some kind of traitor, some kind of mole, some kind of either on top or from the bottom bullshit going on, which I want to speculate with you a bit. But, yeah, like I said, it's one of those things where it's like, I didn't feel good. You know, you see, was it Trinnell? Is that his boyfriend's name? Him running in there and seeing the whole bar on fire and explode. It leaves a bad taste from. But it's not a bad episode. What did you think?
Yeah, no, it's not a bad episode. It's one of the better episodes, I think.
It's a bummer.
Yeah, it's just a bummer. The way it comes together, I thought, was really cool. It was pretty subtle, I guess, the way it came together. They don't dwell on it, and they don't, like, explicitly say, hey, here's what happened that caused, you know, the gun not to be where the gun used to be.
Yeah.
And they just kind of let you think about it. And what I came away with, it might be different from what somebody else came away with, but we do see a shot of the gun at the beginning. So they're trying to, like, let us have the pieces we need to connect the dots. And I think that's pretty rewarding. I enjoyed it. But yeah, man, seeing Sweetie go, Sweetie's been a huge part of the show and a big part that I've enjoyed. So,
and I thought he would make it. Like, I thought he's going to be a Limehouse type of character. Cause, like, sometimes those people who are on the, you know, like I said, the wrong side of the law, but are trying to do good, sometimes Justified finds a way to, let them keep on keeping on, but not this case.
Clem's just, and I like the way they're portraying Clem. You know, he's not an idiot. He's just Clem. You know, he picks up on things very quickly. He's very street smart and very, like, observant.
I thought that too, and I was trying to figure out, like, how to square the circle between someone who's so fucking stupid and who has so little impulse control and someone who's also careful, meticulous about reading expressions and stuff. And I'm like, well, I guess that's the fundamental difference in intelligences, right? You got your IQ, you got your EQ, you got your, you know, social IQ. But, like, this episode, I feel like, kicks over that. No, he's just a dumbass who, for some reason, is being protected by someone on high.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's certainly possible.
But that makes me think that the judge, like, are they going to reveal that this judge guy was, like, a hit all along? That Manziel was being used or was using someone to get that book? And, like, because, like, that... Because otherwise, because Raylan's trying to, like, guys, I thought it was the standard Justified irony of Raylan trying to undo a mystery that we knew was no mystery at all. It was just some kind of random bullshit. And it might go down that way. But now that they're talking about internal corruption and who's protecting Manza, I'm starting to think, like, oh, God, maybe they're. They sure didn't write it that way. If I'm thinking back that first episode, I did not get the idea that. He was waiting for Judge Guy.
Yeah, or that he was called in. I mean, we see him driving in to Detroit at the beginning, you know. But was he called there by somebody to do this hit? And maybe he was just, like, messing around with other things in the meantime. It felt very circumstantial, the way that he ended up in that situation.
I felt like what happened there is that, you know, he's out stealing cars, doing whatever, and Sandy, when she gets a mark on the line, she calls him and he comes in to, you know, play the heavy. And because that's what the whole, like, they were supposed to do the whole scam on Law Garage that night.
Yeah, Judge Guy kind of got in the way in the parking garage and pissed off Clem, and then he decided, you know what, mission B here is kill this
judge.
So
it's this weird thing where it's happenstance and doo-dah, dumb luck, but also a conspiracy that goes all the way to the top.
I don't think it can be both, right?
Right?
It can't. So
well, I got two more episodes left to find out.
Just not a lot of time.
Who do you think the mole in the department is?
I've seen a lot of people talking about the mole and mentioning specifically Marine. And
I find that line of thought pretty compelling.
It's not bad. I'll agree. It's not bad. It's you know, she seems like the least likely person at this point, but that kind of makes her more suspicious in some ways.
Well, especially there's that key. Remember this like throwaway line where her and Raylan were talking about, like, he's like, man, how do you make all this work? You know, you've got this nice house. And she's like, what did she say? You just pretend.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to me, like, they want you to think it's Brill, or they want you to think it's, you know, one of the I don't think it's Wendell.
No,
like, seems like from that he's not one of them bad apples, but he's also not too concerned with trying to find the bad apples, because that's how Detroit works apparently, and that makes me feel good about our justice system. But I think Brill's like, they want you to think it's Brill because he's such a fucking asshole and such a abhorrent example of a police officer. But like, I do think it's going to be Marine, the person that we like, the person that Raylan kind of respects. It's going to be one of those rebukes of like, you can't have it all, Raylan, you know, not and do things right.
Yeah. I mean, the other option is there isn't a mole, and Clem is just that smart not to bring the actual book to the meat before he sees the money.
That is a possibility.
And he just got lucky, right? Again, and Raylan's wrong about, like, that luck means something. Because he's gotten lucky and unlucky many times.
It would be funny if there's two circumstantial, like, you know, the Judge Guy thing was just an accident, and Clem being lucky is just an accident. There's, like, nothing there. But there's also this huge, like, I don't know, the way Raylan said, some combination of this Clem guy, the judge's dirty dealings in this book are like fundamentally warping and changing how things are working in this city. Which is weird, because like I said, I thought some of this stuff in this episode was a left turn at Albuquerque, because like I wasn't getting, I mean, I guess that's it, I just was surprised that they're going down this angle, that like, oh, Clem's got some protection higher up, that this might be orchestrated, this might, because you're right, like you said, it's like they both can't be true at the same time. Unless you got like a Burn After Reading ending. Have you seen that movie that
was that
with the Coen brothers and
yes, and George Clooney and Brad Pitt?
At the end of it, you've got these two CIA officers, and they're what happened?
Yeah.
Oh, this guy came in and killed that guy. Was he working for us? No, he's just a dude from it. It's like, so do we, are we good here? And like, it's like, is this just going to be some bumblefuck farce?
Well, I mean, that's the way Sweetie goes out, right? Like, that bit of luck that protects Clem at the end is just that. It's stupid, blind luck, right?
Is it luck, or did Clem? Because like, to me, I think Clem paid a visit earlier and got that gun. But how would he?
We see the gun. So we see the gun at the beginning. We haven't seen the gun since like episode 3 when Sweetie hit behind the jukebox.
Right.
Now we see the gun in a conspicuous shot at the beginning with Trinnell just kind of having it behind the bar, I guess for protection while Sweetie's out, because he's just a dude at a bar, right? He's not Sweetie.
Right.
And so I think what happened is he just forgot to put it back.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't there. And so that's just dumb luck that gun wasn't there to shoot Clem. And I don't even know
same gun, I guess, because like, I just assumed it was one of the mini guns that Sweetie has planted all over the bar.
It might have.
But you're right. No, I feel like a real idiot now.
Well, I had to go back and look at the episode.
That's like luck. It's like, yeah, if Trinnell took the gun, it's just because he felt nervous because
Sweetie was out, and he's running the bar himself, and there's a lot of bad shit around, right?
It's all caused by Clem, because if Clem doesn't go steal the painting, Lonnie doesn't come by. If Lonnie doesn't come by, Trinelle doesn't get spooked. It's just all a bunch of circumstantial stuff swirling around the Oklahoma Wild Man.
Right? So it might just be that he's lucky. He reads people really well. I mean, that's the other thing, right? Like, he might have read Sweetie better 100%. Than Sweetie thought in that scene and realized this could be a trap, and or I've been getting screwed on these deals. I'm going to make this deal my own by not bringing the book, just taking the cash.
Yeah.
And you know, telling them, look, if you want the book, you need more money.
That's a shitty way to blackmail people.
Is there a good way to blackmail people?
No, but that's like
a just way.
That like leans into the sunk. That seems
it pulls the veil
engineered
back,
engineered to get over the sunk cost fallacy and get into the rip the Band-Aid off. Because it's like, well, shit, if I'm going to get victimized by blackmail and just keep coming back, then this either happens all my entire life where I just go to the cops and, you know, so I don't know.
For sure. So, I don't know what exactly happened there, but all this is to say there doesn't necessarily have to be a mole. It could just be dumb luck.
It could be dumb luck. It could
be a guy
farce.
With a keen sense of, you know, people. Who's, what's going on here? Who's messing with me? Who's on my side? Who isn't? What's
I
the
really
danger?
Can't
what's
tell.
The angle? Yeah.
Is there any potential that Carolyn is doing this? For some reason that she's
the only other one that really could be. Because when you talk about, you know, douche cop, Brill. He's kind of off the case right now, right? We haven't seen him even in
a
room with a conversation.
That he was kept in the loop of this. They mentioned his name as one of the ones that are kept, was informed that they were doing the sting operation. He didn't show up because I think he's still on administrative lead, but I thought it was weird that Mo said that, but I thought it was like, oh, well, here's all the suspects. It's Mo, it's Raylan, it's Wendell, it's Brill, and then she mentioned and a couple of other support units. So it's like, but like, it's one of those four people, right? It has to be.
Or Carolyn, like you said.
Or one of the bosses.
Okay, the chief? The chief is tipping off Clem?
I mean, they had a federal circuit judge on the payroll. Like not just on the payroll, running the payroll. I think she, like, I find, because it's not, is it the... When Raylan went in that guy's office, was that a marshal's office or was that the Detroit Police Department?
I thought it was DPD. Because
I thought he's like, I talked to your boss and your boss said you don't need. So, like, I don't think these are marshals. I think
that's what I thought too, yeah.
The reason Raylan's brought in this is because the whole courtroom protection security is part of the whole marshal's, you know, mission statement. So.
I don't know, man. There's a lot of possibilities.
There's only two more episodes left to untangle this knot.
That's the thing. I'm not discounting anybody either, so they're all still on the table. The option that there is no conspiracy and it's just dumb luck is on the table.
Yeah.
We'll see.
But there are some pieces, like it is late season Justified, so they took at least a rook off the table here in Sweetie. So
speaking
and
of
that's the thing. It's like I was mentioning that, like. Sandy, you talked about how like Clem just gets lucky, and like I just feel like like he's an agent of chaos, and sometimes that works for him. But like what Sandy's doing seems like it's something that he has no idea what's going on, and she's kind of doing her own thing, and it could fuck up his stuff. Kind of like what Sweetie said about Carolyn, like your shit's fucking up with my shit. You know, the fact that Sandy's just doing her own thing at all. With Clem having no idea is, I don't know. I feel like Sandy's the one's going to bring him down.
Yeah, totally could be. I mean, she almost brought Clem down by hiding that gun at Sweetie's, you know, if it weren't for Trinelle having moved it without Sweetie knowing.
Yeah.
Sweetie might have been able to take Clem out.
But she's the one who's Ava Boyd types, so she's never going to be on the right side of the law. It's just...
Yeah.
Can she not murder someone? Can she get away without murdering somebody? You know, can she maintain that kind of like goodness about her?
Maybe.
We'll see.
I'm a little surprised that we have heard not a peep from the Albanians. this late in the season. They have not gotten anything that I would call justice.
Yeah, Raylan brushed them off, and then that's the last thing we saw.
I'm expecting big Albanian moves in the next couple of episodes. But
surely they haven't forgotten about that, right?
You can't. I mean, Klim killed...
Do you think they're hoping we forgot about them?
They spent a whole episode talking about how big a deal it is for them to kill one of their family, right?
Yeah.
There's no way they can just let it go.
Do you think they're hoping we forget so that they can come in for a big old shootout at the end? Yeah. Probably right.
Raylan and Klim will be, you know, showing down in the middle of the street at high noon, and then here come the Albanians to pull his teeth out or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right, maybe we should get into the recap.
Let's do it. There ain't nothing in life that comes for free. That's why we had this ad break. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
It's the 40th anniversary of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom this week. And while the movie might be old enough to belong in a museum, our podcast is brand new. So join us for a conversation on the third or fourth best Indiana Jones movie, depending on who you ask, this Wednesday.
And if retro adventure movies aren't your thing, well, maybe you'll enjoy a time warp in the form of a prequel with the theatrical release of Furiosa. Flashback with us to a time when Charlize Theron looked like Anna Taylor-Joy. And strap in for another epic George Miller action movie this Thursday on Bald Move Pulp.
And finally, we're wrapping up our four-week coverage of the 1980 TV miniseries Shogun. Get the final verdict on Yabu, JB, Mariko, and the rest of the gang this Thursday on Bald Move Prestige.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Home is wherever the podcast takes me. Welcome back to the Justified Podcast.
We start off with Raylan, who can't sleep. Carolyn comes calling at his hotel room with information that he might want about the book, and she tells him just how significant it is that she trusts him, and he invites her inside.
I think that all of the bullshit in hotels nowadays is terrible for people who are trying to get a good night's sleep on the road. They got that because I'm frequently sleepless in a hotel room, I'm staring at the ceiling. You can't help but notice all the fucking blinking shit, the smoke alarms and the CO2. The fact that like most hotels now have like motion sensing air conditioning so it shuts off like at nighttime.
Oh,
unless you're like
fuck
moving
you.
Dude,
that's when I need it the most.
I know. I'm like, I'm going to set this thing up to, you know, so I can get a nice good. And it's just like I wake up to sweating like a crazy person. Then it kicks on, of course, because I'm moving around and fuck all the hotel experience. It's like they're in a race for the bottom between them and Airbnb.
You gotta figure out.
Is there
a way
anything
to
else
use...
to talk about in this scene, or just want to talk about the hotel experience?
I mean, she's talking. She's saying the right things to the right person here, you know, about not legal but just. Raylan deeply understands the concept of it's not legal but it's just.
Justified is the name of the show. Now, she's either being completely straight with him or so manipulative that it's almost unforgivable. There's no middle lane. And I think it's so interesting the juxtaposition of this scene and the later one. Where
Raylan is
mm-hmm. not trusting her, and she's trying to get him to relax and come inside.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I don't think that Carolyn is the rat, but it's stuff like that that makes me think they're at least tagging up on that base to make us suspicious.
Yeah, so there's a direct line from Carolyn to Clem through Sweetie.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember exactly how much Raylan knows about that. Like those back channels.
He doesn't.
That's the thing.
He's wanting to.
It's the thing that makes me wonder if there isn't a mole. Because Raylan doesn't know that Carolyn is talking to Sweetie about the book day in and day out.
Yeah.
No, actually he does. He does, because she came to him with the name for Diane. So.
But he doesn't know about the Sweetie thing, right?
I guess he doesn't know about the Sweetie stuff and how she would want to warn Sweetie,
right,
about this. Yeah,
she didn't know about the Lonnie. She didn't know about the Lonnie stuff. Like it's funny because like the four people trying to coordinate the sting, there was one extra thing that they didn't know about that Evans, and then the person that knew about that one didn't know. It's this kind of like rock paper scissors information game they're playing.
Yeah, which is kind of a hallmark of Justified, which I really love.
That's why now Raylan coming into the penultimate episode is like, fuck it, I want answers. I'm tired, you know, because he's getting run around by somebody.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk about that scene when we get there at the end.
The thing is like,
weird.
How does she continue to use the book in ways that are not legal but are very... Is she saying that, like, is that statement saying I'm foregoing... this justice because I'm going to give you the book and that's what the stakes are? Or is she, because like I kind of thought that maybe she thought she could use the book after they make the arrest. I'm like, that's not going to happen, right?
No, I mean, it's probably,
and she already used it, like arguably she took her, what you would call her chief political rival, Diane, took her down with the book.
Yeah, she's out of the picture, out of the running for this judge position.
And she knows Diane's dirty, and dirty in a way that is particularly offensive. Because, again, she doesn't care about law-breaking so much, but, like, you help a police officer get away with shooting an unarmed, young black man? Yeah, she's going to take exception to that.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's a case of she is about to do something that she shouldn't technically do because Clem is her client. But I don't know that's legally binding.
I don't know about legal, but like she could probably get disbarred over any three things that's happened in the last three episodes.
Oh, yeah.
And Raylan could get thrown out of the Marshal Service for any three things he's done in the last three episodes too. And one of the things that they share in common is doing each other. I'm pretty sure you're not allowed as a defense attorney.
I can't imagine.
To fuck a police, the chief investigator on your client's case. And I'm pretty sure if you're a marshal, you're not allowed to fraternize with the defense of the primary suspect of your investigation. Mm-hmm. All really messy for very obvious good reasons. Naughty, very naughty to Raylan and Carolyn here.
But until now, she's been very defensive of Clem, right? Like, she's been, you know, this is my client. Go do your thing and do it the right way, and we'll see if you get him, because it's my job to protect him. Now she's coming to him saying, I think we can get this guy. but I have to break some rules to do it. That's what I was getting from the scene. But
yeah, and I'm going to tell you what I think you need to know, and you're going to have to trust me with the rest. But now Raylan's burnt. He feels like he's been burnt, and he's going to want the whole answer.
And part of this conversation was, obviously, we're going to need to go blackmail the DA, right? Because we don't have the actual evidence we need. I've seen a name in a book, but I can't prove it. It's just my word against
hers. There's a lot of asses being hung out
stuff
in this episode, right? Like when Mo says to Diane, look, Diane, you think I would come with you if I didn't have this dead to rights? She hasn't got shit.
No.
She's got a cell phone photo of this page. Maybe.
Maybe if Diane took one. And that's the thing.
And
Raylan
didn't.
I
don't think Raylan showed it to her. Like, because it's like she's having to. She's saying, like, it's funny because, like, she's a cop. She's saying, this is thin, thin, thin. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. And then to the mark, she's like, we got you dead to rights. I wonder if there's an intentional juxtaposition to see how the civilian white collar criminals deal with a police press versus, like, we saw the three way press they put on Sweetie, Sandy, and Clem, and they just, like, fuck you, I ain't telling nothing. Whereas, you know, Diane thought she was in control, but she rolled pretty quickly.
Yeah, I did notice how they were treating her just like they would some criminal they were sweating, right? Because, I mean, she is a criminal.
When
she's
dropped it was a moment when Raylan, when she was like, what do you want from me? Oh, nothing that we wouldn't want from any other CI. Like, that's got to sting as a prosecutor, as a big dick swinging prosecutor.
It's a big demotion, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a slap in the face.
Let's go over to Bert Dickey going to a trailer to ask one of his former employees, Lonnie, to get his painting back. Lonnie has some demands that might include a severance package that he didn't get when he was fired for stealing from Bert. There's a lot of trust stuff this episode. You know, he's talking about how you completely betrayed my trust with Lonnie, stole from him.
I've hit so much pay dirt with my crazy hunches that, like, this might be an overreaction, but...
Oh, boy.
Are Bulldozer and Lonnie lovers?
Oh, my God. Everyone's banging in this show.
I'm just saying.
Carolyn, Raylan, Sweetie, Trinell. Yeah.
I'm just saying. I've been right. This might be the third time. This might be the third time that blows up my charm. I don't know. But, like, I got
Brill
a little bit of
dog
hint.
Lovers. That's what I want to know.
That would be Lonnie. You
his
know,
police
is,
dog.
He's. I thought you were talking about
the police dog. Yeah.
I thought you were talking about this dog that got sicked on
Bulldozer. No, he's definitely sicking dogs on him. I don't know about the lover angle, but there's definitely some hurt feelings here, for
it's
sure.
It's just they're being very cagey about the nature of the partnership that got blown up over the thievery. I thought it was interesting. Well, I don't know. They got Cross's reaction to hearing Lonnie get his brains blown out? I guess it wasn't that of, like, an anguished lover. But then again, this is a relationship that broke bad.
Sure. Yeah. He's going to the Bahamas. Maybe the Bahamas was the place where they met. He's going there to memorialize him. I don't know.
But going back to Kokomo.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they continuing to go on about the stay in the garlic? I thought maybe some more information had come up in the last few weeks, and I tried to do another search for, like, Stanley Gar. I cannot find anything about.
Nah, it feels like a thing. Just a thing they made a thing.
Is this an executive producer that paints on the side? Because, like, a 30-second infomercial. Like, David Cross is this close to being a Home Shopping Network guy. Like, next we got the Stanley Garlic. Oh, man, look at the colors. Look at the brushwork.
Call now for easy payments of $29.99.
Grandkids will love it. Got to get him a Stanley Garlic.
How much do you think that garlic's worth? I know Sandy's going to take it to the appraisal, to the gallery later to get it appraised.
I've got no fucking clue, man. Like, is it worth like 30 grand? That's what it feels like the show is treating it. Is that what it's worth?
Because he says he dabbles. He's not like a big player in art. Art collection, but he dabbles and he's enthusiastic. I could see a guy like that having a sub $100,000 painting for sure. But that might. Here's the thing that completely boggles my mind every time they start talking about stuff is how little money they think is enough money to run away with. Like, dude, Sandy's got that $6,000 in her hand, and she is out the 1 foot out the door to the Bahamas, ready to go. That'll buy you like a week's worth of drinks in a hotel room in the Bahamas, man. I mean, if you want to stay in the nice places, which she clearly likes nice things.
Did they not bother to update the amounts in the original Leonard Elmore novel? Because like maybe 30 years ago, if you got $50,000, you could go and like hide in the Bahamas for a year. Because the other thing I thought is like, maybe they're not looking to disappear forever. This isn't a dentist cashing out his policy going to Belize like season one Justified plan. This is more like, we have got a lot of heat on us. Let's get good. Let's get out, live up, you know, let's get out of the city for 6-8 weeks, live it up, and then we can come back and run a new scam. Because maybe. You're right. $20,000,
yeah,
is not enough to do shit on the run.
No, I wouldn't think so. So that's what I'm thinking. Like, I'm unimpressed with Sandy's idea of what a lot of money is, and she thinks that this painting could be worth a lot of money, so I will be unimpressed with the total they're willing to offer her, I think. So $30,000, yeah, that might feel right. And she's going to go, oh my God, $30,000 sold. And then she's going to try and get out of here, I assume, right? Or does she take this money back to Clem and be like, hey, Clem, I got our money for us. Let's leave. And then he says, no, I got stuff to do. One final betrayal.
I don't know, man. I don't know how much, how bamboozled Clem's got her, because... I was hoping like, oh my God, this is the first smart thing you've done all season. I mean, I don't know if you're going to be successful, but like get your bag and get the fuck out. Get so far away from this guy.
Right.
So
that's what I would tell her.
I do feel like there is a change in their relationship, like that her impassioned plea of like, I got to believe you when you say you're ready to bounce, and him saying, oh, baby, don't worry about it. I'm never going to let anything hurt. When we all, like, I even think she knows now that he would serve her up on a platter. It would keep him out of jail or out of the grave one more day. Like, he doesn't give a fuck about her.
You're absolutely right about that.
I think she realizes
it now.
Does
she know it? Has she internalized it, you know? Has she realized it or internalized it? Because
the fact she went out with that painting and tried to sell it, like, she knows that is going to... I mean, probably provoke violence from Clint, and she knows how dangerous he is. So it's like, to me, that felt like a crossing of the Rubicon. But I'm dealing with a woman that thinks $15,000 is retirement money in Kokomo.
The tropics,
so.
Yeah.
Maybe on the fictional island of Kokomo, you could live for $10,000, but
it could also be that, you know, Clint promised her just $20,000 and we'll get out of here, and she thinks this painting is worth that, and so she's selling it to get their money so they can leave together.
And she does love the guy. I mean, yeah. She started off the season like pretty madly in love with him. So you can, turns out you can really manipulate people a lot if they love you.
Yeah.
Pro tip.
Pro tip. Life hack.
Unethical life hack. Yeah.
Clem and Sweetie talk about tape players as they wait for their next mark to arrive at the parking garage rooftop. When he does, Sweetie makes the exchange, and he starts to make the exchange, the page for cash. Unfortunately, the guy doesn't have $15,000 that they want, and wants to know if they'll take $12,000 instead. Clem is predictably upset. He rams the guy's car with theirs. The guy gets out, runs to the ledge, and jumps over, splatting on the ground. Wow.
The thing is I don't totally disagree with Clem's criminal analysis here.
Yep. Nobody's got $12,000 that ain't got $15,000. He's 100% right on that.
There's $3,000. Although I think they're telling us something that like the next scene with Sandy, they don't have $15,000. They just have the $12,000.
He says it's in his wallet. What are they gonna do? Go down to the body and get?
I thought they were. Like, I thought that's like the explicit understanding. Like, you're in a parking garage. What are you going to do? Not go to the first floor? While you're on the first floor, grab the guy's wallet, you know?
Stop by the body that we just created.
Boom.
Stop by the crime scene.
No, I thought...
Leave our fingerprints.
I thought this was all nuts, but I did think that was the plan. And I thought they were telling us that Clem is... His instincts aren't as good as they... But I thought fundamentally his criminal instinct is fine. It's just that, like, you don't jump... to ramming a guy's Prius off a garage and chase him off the roof. Like,
Yeah, he says he didn't pull his gun. I'm like, dude, you did more than pull a gun.
Send Sweetie back over with Clem glaring at him from across the parking lot the whole time and be like, look, man, this is the last time I'm coming to talk to you. And my supervisor wants his 15 grand. So do you have a plan to get us this extra three large in the next 15 minutes? Or do I need to send the supervisor over? And you probably get, but everything he says about the new, everything he says about the car salesmanship and the angle of it, like, fuck yeah, hell yeah. Uh-huh. You and I have done a car deal where we rolled up at a place with like 1500 and I'm like, bring 12. And fuck if that guy didn't take it, right? So like,
it works. Yeah, for sure. It's those negotiating tactics. And Clem knows it. I mean, Clem, that's the thing about Clem that's so frustrating is he's so damn smart in that regard. He can assess just like everything going on around him in the moment with extreme ease. And yet he's so impulsive that he can't help but fuck everything up.
He's also really insecure. Like, I think the only thing that's really important to him is his musical talent, which unfortunately he has none.
Yeah.
And
it's not amazing. He's no Jack White for sure.
But that's like, he wants to be a rock star and he's got every single fucking piece of the package, except for there's not enough autotune in the world. So I think that's one of the big things that makes him this because he's trying to be a rock star this other way.
He doesn't have the voice, but he does have the balls for sure.
Yes. And we've seen lots of clinking when he walks, apparently.
All right, let's go to Raylan telling Maureen that he knows about the book, that Sweetie and Manziel are using it to shake people down. He wants to try and catch Manziel with the book on him, and he has a plan to use a name in the book to do it. And Maureen also, over the course of this conversation, just totally figures out that he's sleeping with Carolyn.
The look on Raylan's face just blindsides him with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's like, it's not like she's led on the whole conversation, and then like she just hits him like, you're sleeping with his lawyer, aren't you? And Raylan's like,
he's got no. You're talking to the lead detective on a big case. You should probably realize she's good at detecting.
I don't feel like Timothy Oliphant gets enough credit for his comedic timing and just instincts. Like, he's very funny without trying to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, the look is just it's great. Sure. Evidence that Mo is not the mole.
Okay.
I was trying to think of, like, would she have enough time to put this together if she was the mole? Or is there some kind of... Nah, I don't think I got anything in here. It's just one of those things where it's like, she is putting... She's the lead person. She is keeping all of the cards intentionally close. Like, to saying, like, hey, there's only, like, three or four people in this whole thing that know what's going down. Surely she's got to know this puts a big target on her back if this thing gets interfered with. So it's like, is she
You would almost want to call an all hands meeting and tell everybody this is what we're doing, right? So that everybody's a potential mole.
Yeah.
Spread that suspicion around.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe she's maximally leveraged like Diane is. So she has to do something stupid because she's being forced to do it. It's not her choice.
Yeah, if they get the book, I mean, she would be implicated, you know?
She's That's playing possible. It really fucking cool. Like, Mo is like, went up several levels in my estimation for being able to pull this off because, like I said, she is fucking with Raylan at the end of this conversation when her heart and mind's got to be racing and spinning.
Assuming she's the mole, yeah, definitely.
Again, So I don't know.
And she's going toe-to-toe with a fabrication, with the DA, with just a total fabrication. Like, we don't have anything on her. If she doesn't go for this, we're screwed. And my career is probably over.
Yeah.
And she nails it, so.
Although maybe she's not afraid because, like Diane observes at the end of the scene, like, I'm pretty much finished. So maybe she's like, well, either way, I come out of this with a person who's going to maybe if she loves an attack, it's like she's like, whoa, the person who took $100,000 bribe to let an officer kill some unarmed kid. Oh, there she's the one talking about a corrupt police. Oh, interesting, huh? Yeah, it's like it's one of those things where she just did the math and like there's not a threat here.
Yeah, and she basically says that like the court of public opinion is going to convict you regardless of whether we have.
Well, she know in her bones that Diane's on that book because she's intimately familiar with the book. So that way she would convincingly be able to say, I know I've got the goods on you, Diane, but from a corrupt way instead of a...
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how familiar she'd be with that book. She's
I go back to that scene with Judge Guy.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Guy waving that book around and saying, like, you don't want to be doing this in my office because I got stuff on you. I got stuff on your boss. Like, he made it seem like everyone in that room, except for maybe Raylan, could potentially be implicated by people asking too many questions about his. So, like, it could be Marine's boss. It could be Marine herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, we will.
Lonnie goes to Sweetie's to see him, but he's not there, so he just decides to wait at the bar. This is the scene where we see Trinnell. He's actually got the gun behind the bar before Lonnie shows up. At the very beginning of this scene, we see a shot of him kind of moving it around behind the bar. And I don't know. So there's a... At the very beginning of this scene, he's also getting a text or texting somebody and not getting a response. And that might be Sweetie. And he might be getting worried just in general, which is why he has the gun back there.
And it looks like some of, like, he... I don't know whether this is just Sweetie's bar... But he's got, like, the neighborhood support there. You know, like, Lonnie, I think, considers rolling tough on him. Because, you know, Trinnell looks like a guy like Lonnie could roll tough on. And he glances over, and there's, like, five people down at the bar kind of sizing Lonnie up. And he's like, nah, this is not the right. There's too much Sweetie love in this place for me to overcome with my physical presence. So
yeah, you're out of your element, Lonnie.
And that's a damn shame, because it turns out, like, there was no real threat here. Like, should have left a gun in a jukebox.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your people had it handled, Trinnell. Oh, man.
Yeah.
It's a tragedy, because, like, five things have to go wrong for Sweetie to be dead at the end of this episode, and they all did.
Mm-hmm. Let's go over to Sandy. She is happy to have more money coming in. She's at the, Del Weems place. Sweetie's there. Clem's there. Sweetie notices that Clem still has this garlic painting in the apartment and realizes... He went back to Bert's afterward. He's pissed about that. But then Trinnell calls Sweetie and says, somebody named Lonnie's at the bar to see him. Sweetie says, I'm on my way. And so he leaves. And then Sandy asks Clem, how much more money do we need before we leave? And he says, $20,000. And he reassures her, everything's going to be fine.
Yeah, this is where I think Sandy opened her eyes. Like, she wanted him to be honest and... reassure her, and he does, but I don't think
he gives her a firm number. That's the one thing that I think Sandy is still hanging on here and why she might be taking this cash back to him.
Yeah,
he gives her that exact number, $20,000.
So if she brings $20,000 back, she can say, okay, baby, here's $20,000, let's get out of here.
And then he can disappoint her the final time. Yeah. By saying, I still got the book. I still got things to do, She's got scores to settle with Raylan,
And I don't think she's appropriately afraid of Clem.
I agree. But, yeah. I agree, man. No, I think she is so on the hook with this guy.
This is where I had in my notes, like, why are they acting like $25,000 is, like, an insane amount of money?
Yeah.
But we kind of talked about the scene a lot in terms of breaking down the debate, because we had the negotiation tactics, which, again, I think Clem's instincts are right. His just, he's jumping to beating people to lead pipe way too quick, especially since, like, none of these people seem like they're criminals. In like the hardened sense of the word. This fucker's driving a Prius and he's so pissing his pants scared of Clem, he jumps off a building rather than take him. Like, look at the bulldozer. Like, David Cross is many things, but, like, criminally intimidating, not one of those. Like, agreed. I don't think they need a big heavy. They need a smooth, charming guy that knows how to work the angles like Sweetie.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking Clem. What more can you say?
Yeah, well, he wants it all, man. He wants it all, and you don't get it all by taking $3K less than you expected to get.
He wants to be the rock star.
So Maureen and Raylan go to see the DA, Diane, and they tell her that they have her name in the book listing bribes. And she was apparently, I don't know how they would get this information, but she was apparently taking bribes to let guilty cops off the hook for shooting people without cause. They put pressure on her to help them out. She doesn't answer, but I have it on pretty good authority that she caved.
Yeah. I like how she calls Raylan the rodeo clown from the bar. There's also some really good dialogue here when, you know, mm-hmm. Mo comes up. It's like, oh, looks like you've had the day from hell. And she goes, hell would have spit this day out and called it overcooked. I want to add that to my...
goes back to the Clem stuff earlier, right?
Yeah.
Clem sending his steak back.
Yeah. I want to add that to my phrase bank, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But she says it's just, so that's the thing. She says it's just you, me, Wendell, and Brill, and a couple of units to back up. But now that couple of units does a lot of heavy lifting, because I hear couple of units, I'm thinking mm-hmm. that's at least four other officers.
Yeah, the cops and their partners, yeah.
Yeah, so 50% of the possible co-conspirators we've never seen on camera know their names.
Mm-hmm.
But from the named ones, you look at, it can't be Raylan.
No, obviously not.
It's got to be Mo, Wendell, or Brill. And I think Brill is too easy to suspect. Maybe it's Wendell.
Man, I don't want it to be Wendell, because Wendell best of the cops.
Legit break my heart. It'll be like fucking We Own the City all over again.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Like, goddamn, the one guy that seems like he's got his shit together and trying to do a decent job, but he's the one that's still... Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe most too perfect to mole
Raylan in an alley or something accidentally.
Could you say the most too perfect because they have foreshadowed, you know, the whole like, oh, just fake it to, you know, and she looks a little too comfortable to be a cop.
I do want foreshadowing, you know, I just want it to be such good foreshadowing that maybe I didn't see it coming until they pointed out.
Yeah. And I would not see the Wendell coming, but I don't think they've laid many tracks there, too.
I don't think so either. He shuts this conversation with Raylan down pretty hard when Raylan's like, you know, something doesn't feel right here about this whole thing.
I want to talk. Instead of talking about that now, let's wait. I do want to go over that because, like, it's a really interesting conversation.
All right. I'll just say, yeah, he shuts that down pretty hard. So
he does.
You know, maybe too hard. You know, maybe he gets a little too defensive, but we'll talk about it here in a bit. We got to get out of this town alive. We'll be right back.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more.
We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
I just poured a fresh shot of bourbon. We're back with more Justified. I really like, you know, how they are treating her like the criminal that she is, like they would any other criminal, right? Like, time comes, we'll do what we can to minimize the effect on you.
And like you can tell that's any other not... CI. She's like, this. She's one of those people that...
She knows those promises are complete bullshit.
Well, it's not just that. Unless it's in writing. More... Like, she thought that she never thought this day would come, number one.
That too,
and when
yeah.
she did, she's like all this bluster and jockeying and but then at the end, she's got to go along with it because they are blackmailing her. And mm-hmm. it's way easier to do this and avoid jail than it is to.
And they certainly seem like they have the goods. I mean, everything they're saying here, the thing that bothers me in this is they're saying some things that are very specific. Like, you mm-hmm. took bribes to get bad cops off the hook for bad shootings. That's very specific. And if they're wrong about that, then she would know that they don't actually have anything on her. Why do they go so specific? Because I don't think they have that information.
So I think Carolyn suspected that Diane had done some dirty things. And if you are a friend, okay. like, you know, if you're a defense attorney, your friend, the prosecutor attorney, followed their career, you see a date and an amount and like a coded, you know, like you could probably go yeah. back and like, oh shit, that was for the trial where. So it's like one of those things where like, I don't
take
think
an educated guess on it.
Yeah. Especially if you see patterns. Cause I didn't mm-hmm. think there's a single entry. She even said pages.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where, like, I think a smart person like Carolyn could go through there and see that pattern. Because that's mm-hmm. people that, like, do this coded shit, then they think they're so fucking clever. It's like, codes are hard to break if you have, like, a paragraph or, like, a page or something. But, like, if you got a whole fucking book and
sure.
you got uncoded stuff like dates and times and transaction amounts, it's not that fucking hard to piece that together. Like, there's teams of forensic accountants that do just that. So like mm-hmm. I think they're kind of fooling themselves, but
okay, so it's a very educated guess. They're not just fishing here. They have some really good ideas of what she probably did.
And hell, maybe Diane's crazy enough to get drunk and tell Carolyn she's done it. You know, like as they were like drinking buddies at the bar kind of levels of mm-hmm. acquaintance, you know, professional acquaintances. So,
you know, the umbrella and the sparkler in this drink really reminds me of the time where I let those cops off the hook, took that bribe. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I had one of these directly after that. Uh-huh. I went to two more of these,
Carolyn, and I'll be ready to get a unarmed van murderer off the streets, you know?
Oh man. All right, let's go over to Sweetie arriving back at the bar, and he talks with Lonnie, who is surprisingly pleasant. You know, he asks him to give up Clem's location so he can go get the painting, and Sweetie gets a call from Diane, who is still in the office with Maureen and Raylan while she's talking to him. She offers $30,000 for him to destroy her page in the book, and they set a meeting place and time, and then Sweetie sees an angle to finally get out, and he goes back over to Lonnie, gives him the $6,000 that he got from the last blackmail job, and tells him he can have the 30 more from Diane and the garlic painting as long as he kills Clem at the meet. Which is interesting that he's phrasing it like that, because so far he's the only one going to this meet. Clem knows nothing about it. I think that was the scene where he convinces him to go is very fun.
It's very fun. Although on second watch, I was like trying to figure out, you know, the whole like, did Clem know just organically because he's that good at reading people, or did Clem? So this scene is like with Lonnie and Trinnell, where he fixes him a fresco. This is where I thought that like there is something to Lonnie and the bulldozer, because when Lonnie walks up to Trinnell, and like, you know, through through inference figures out that he's in a relationship with Sweetie, you think that like, oh, he's going to say something homophobic because that's where the scene was going. But like he instantly turns on a dime and it's like, how long you been together? 7 years. And he still doesn't tell you where he's going. Like, to me, that is sympathizing on a relational level that I don't think a dude like Lonnie busts into a bar and does unless he's got some first-rate commiserating to do on his own, you know? You're giving me the Aaron's crazy look. So, like, I might be, but...
Potentially. I mean, it could also just be that he wants to find out where Sweetie is and where that painting is. So he's playing all the angles, right?
Yeah.
Trying to be like, you really trust him that much? Why are you not giving up his location? He doesn't trust you. Why don't you just, you know, tell me where he is?
And we see for the first time when he sits across from Lonnie, like, you know, we've heard like Sweetie is Detroit. Like, you know, he knows everybody's run everything, done stuff on both sides of the law. But like this guy having this conversation, and like you can see Lonnie trying to figure him out too, like, are you know, like he calls him, like, I'm not seeing her a house cat, like it says, which is his way of saying like, I respect you, I don't want to do like an op on you, but I also got to get paid and I got to get this painting.
I like this scene a lot. It's not your typical, you know, criminals waving their dicks at each other, right? This is like two dudes who want, each of them wants a thing. Yeah. And the other, and they're being really respectful to each other while acknowledging, I'm trying to get what I need to get, and I'm willing to give you what you want as long as we can make an arrangement here.
Yeah, I feel like this is Elmer, because, you know, there's certain types of criminals he writes, and they're either stupid or they're clever. And the clever ones, and then they're either heart of gold or fucking rotten bastards. That's the axis of the Elmer Leonard villains. And I feel like here we have the like heart of gold, smart, clever, like, you know, like we know that Sweetie could have been something, except for a few things kind of went down, you know, he got mixed up with Clem, maybe even romantically, but it's just a pleasure to see like competent, dangerous. And that's like what's like Sweetie says is like, or, you know, as he's listening, like, well, why, you know, after you've been laying quiet, why are you doing all this now? And he's like, well, maybe this or maybe that. Or maybe I just missed sitting across a table like this from a man like you having a conversation like this. Like, and this, the electricity.
I love it, man, because like this gives you a glimpse into what Sweetie could have had if he wasn't hooked up with some lunatic, right? I mean, he is much, much smoother and much cooler headed than Clem. And Lonnie's that guy, too. If they had teamed up instead of him and Clem, they probably could have pulled off crimes forever, you know, and never got caught.
And I don't think Sweetie is a pushover either. Like, no. Clem later in the episode's like, I'm the one that always got to do the dirty work. I'm always got, but like, you know, if you're with a roommate and like they accuse you of never doing the dishes, and you're like, what the fuck, dude? If there's one single spoon in the sink, you fucking do the dishes. Like, you know, like, if you're like kicking someone's ass 3 seconds into a conversation, how can you say that I don't have what it takes to be the heavy? Like, you're just like the heavy right off the bat.
Well, there's another. So Clem says that and accuses, you know, Sweetie of not pulling his weight. But you look at the Wrecking Crew thing that they did. And Sweetie didn't come in waving a gun and threatening people, but he set that whole thing up. I mean, he's in there doing the work of charming these guys, lulling them into a sense of security, getting the information, knowing where the money is. The same thing that Sandy is doing for Clem, and Clem would give her zero credit. And in fact, does
I
the
do
same
all
thing.
The work. I do all the work.
I come in and I swing the gun around and I force people to give us what we want. Yeah, but you didn't know where the shit was in the first place. You couldn't set up a mark if your life depended on it. He just doesn't value what other people bring to that operation.
Is that part of, but I think he does, because like this is part of the book thing. I think for the first time in his life, he feels like I found the thing and I'm not getting the proper amount of credit for not only being the hunter, but also the guy to close the, I'm the closer too, you know, those are
sure.
And I think there's a bit of that, but also it's like, well, it's mid shit, dude. You don't give anyone credit for what they do. So
even though the results of his actions and his methods of negotiation are getting assassins on his tail, Like,
yeah.
If things go a little bit differently here, he's dead in the park today, you know?
You got this. It does make sense. You got this whole book. You hit 10 of the softest guys for like a total of $100,000-$200,000, and then you get to fuck out. And then you run out of money a year from now.
Yeah, come back and do it again.
Maybe guys got less bark on him this time. Maybe there's a... You can... For probably 5 to 10 years, this stuff is going to be hot enough to use on people. So, like, it just... I mean, Clem's a very clever, dumb guy. What else can you say?
Yeah, very observant, able to connect dots, but...
And that's only if he's not getting supplied intelligence directly from the police, because I'm ready to call him a fucking grand idiot if it turns out that he's just getting, like, Maureen's calling him on a cell phone and be like, Raylan's on his way, LOL, hide the book. Like...
Mm-hmm. And this is where the episode starts to get really interesting with all the different angles and all the different players, you know, Lonnie going in, we get, you know, the sting operation, you got Clem out there who's not going to have the book on him. It's all going to really come together great at the end.
Mm-hmm. And poor Bulldozer thinking he's just doing like, oh, I just like, he's on the world. Like, it's like, you got my painting yet? This low stress, easy Boom. Steal, no yeah. killing anybody, and.
Mm-hmm. What's better than Fresca?
Apparently, whatever Trinella will fake with soda water and a little bit of
lime, lemons, and limes, maybe. Is it,
yeah,
he might have just squirted some Sprite or 7-Up or something in the. Because I noticed they make the sounds of like ice and just like liquid spraying, right? So whatever it is, it's on tap.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think he even saw him use the. I'm pretty sure it's like just soda. Yeah. You might be right. Maybe he put some bitters in there. Some.
Maybe it's just water. And he's like, oh yeah, that's better than Fresca. Just tap water.
It was sparkling. It was sparkling tap water. I definitely noticed that. Fair. Maybe Sweetie's just got CO2 plumbed to his water pipe. Yeah, so
maybe.
All right, like, Clem. Shit, my urinals are sparkling. This is, what do you think? This is some shitty hole in the wall jazz, but nah.
Why does that sound so bad? I feel like that would put things in the air that you don't want in the air.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's enough foam and weird shit going on
in your urinal
situation. You don't need CO2.
Oh, God. All right, let's go to Clem. Clem comes to Sweetie's to invite him to test drive his new car stereo. Sweetie cons him into going to the Diane meet alone by pretending he doesn't want him there, saying he's too crazy. I really like this scene, man. I think Sweetie knows just how to play Clem. A couple episodes ago, he said, like, to Carolyn, I got this guy. I know this guy. I can handle this when he's talking about I've got an opportunity with the book. And I think he does. He really knows him. It just doesn't quite work out for him because of circumstance.
That's the thing. When I rewatched this scene, and I rewatched it a couple times, Sweetie is so smooth, I don't know what edge or crack that Clem caught on to before he's... Because it just seemed like it was a foolproof... So subtle, such a fine trap that there's just no way he could see it coming. Because organically used a part of their relationship that was building, and like a small, like, hey, it's just a milk run. I don't need you doing your fucking easily provoked vanilla gorilla routine on this bullshit, man. Like, and Clem's like, you know, a little hurt and wounded, but also like I don't see how he figured it out. There was no tell at all.
Here's the thing. Maybe he doesn't figure it out. So he could both not figure it out in this scene and also there be no mole, and those things still work out that Clem just doesn't bring the book to the meet because he's talking about... I mean, look at the way Clem's behaved before, right? Like, he's talking about how he's gotten screwed in the last two deals. He's not going to get screwed again. So he does not bring the book just because he doesn't want to get
sense.
Screwed.
And then he sees Lonnie kind of like make him, and he's like, yeah, that. Because I did see
so
that.
It could be
there
both.
Was, there's a flash of recognition, or like, ah, I get it now, when Lonnie walked past.
Oh, he eyes him the entire time he's walking by.
So he doesn't bring the book.
Uh-huh. Or a
gun.
Yeah,
you're right. Why not a gun, though?
That's a good question. Okay, the gun might be literally the smoking
gun on whether there's
a mole.
This has more evidence that he completely was hornswoggled by Sweetie, because Sweetie said this is a milk run. Like, it's he's like, well, I'm going to trust Sweetie. I'm not going to bring a gun. Maybe Sweetie's
trying
right.
to
Maybe
prove
I...
to Sweetie that he can do this without being the hothead, body-leaving criminal, you know?
Yes. Yes.
If there is a mole, this is a really smart misdirect, because it's very plausible that he just left all that shit behind to prove something to Sweetie.
And suppose this is a pretty straight up adaptation of the Leonard novel. So, like, I buy that. That's a hallmark, you know.
This is a really smartly written thing, yeah.
And it's well done, because, like, you could do this on the page, but, like, everyone's got to do their thing exactly right to pull this off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty sophisticated.
I love it. And it plays on... It feeds into what we're going to see later, and kind of what we've been seeing all along with the relationship between Clem and Sweetie, where Clem really looks up to Sweetie. You know, he wants his approval desperately, and you can see that. And that would be the reason why he wants to go on this run. And Sweetie knows that, and Sweetie uses that.
I know that as a Blaupunkt.
Oh, the stereo manufacturer? Yeah.
I know that they were, especially back in the day, a well-regarded stereo manufacturer of car stereos. But, like, ever since MacGruber, I can't take this brand seriously. And, like, I howled with laughter the second he started crowing about his Blaupunkt.
Do they do, like, a whole thing with Blaupunkt?
Oh, yeah, he's got that fucking shitty Miata with the Blaupunkt removable dash radio always stuck. And, yeah.
I didn't realize it was a Blaupunkt. Okay.
Yeah, it's a Blaupunkt!
Jesus.
There's three people in the audience that get that joke, the scene that movie.
And then we get the scene where Sandy takes the garlic painting into an art gallery to try to sell it. She's playing this really weird, right? I feel like it's strange to come into an art gallery looking to get some, you know, a fair deal for your painting that you think is worth a bunch of money, saying, I have no idea about art. I just want to ask you some questions about art. And then showing them the painting and saying, oh, my mother, you know, it's her medical bills, we got to sell it. She seems to be undermining her own plan here by saying, I know nothing about this, please tell me what it's worth. And then, like, trying the play of pulling the heartstrings to get more money.
Well, I think it's like what I understood from this is Sandy is a pretty sophisticated operator, but she only runs a very specific scam. And, like, it's a well-known fact that, like, if you want to get a man's attention, pretend to be a little bit dumber than you are and ask them to explain them something. Like, if you want to find, like, 10 guys to date tonight and you're a woman, go to a Home Depot plumbing aisle and look confused. Okay. And you will have, like, air traffic controllers will have to, like, organize the stack of the guys swooping in to get in there. And I feel like that's what she's doing the, I'm a poor, dumb girl, and I don't understand anything, and I'm down, and I need money. But it's not some dumb, drunk guy at a casino. It's a sophisticated art deal that now sees her as the mark. That's what I got, that she's young, she's experienced in a certain type of thing, of manipulation to get what she wants, and that's what she's trying here because she's desperate. Does that
definitely.
Does that track with your experience as a young woman?
I do that every the weekend. I'm at the Home Depot.
Our producer's shaking her head. She's got experience being a young woman. So there we go.
But she doesn't know anything about this painting is the problem, right? Like she tells him that up front. I wish she wouldn't have told him that up front. I wish she would have gone with the sympathetic, you know, I need money for my mother's medical bills kind of thing, but not walked in and said, I know nothing about art. Please take advantage of me.
Yeah, she should be a little bit more sophisticated than that.
And this guy, you know, he could tell her it's worth $2,000 and she'd probably have to believe him because what
does
she know?
And the look in his face tells me he's sizing her up for, like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And we don't come back to this.
This is a shady mechanic where someone has come up and be like, it's making a funny noise and I don't know what it is. And he's like,
Yeah. How much do I think they know about it?
Right. How, do they know nothing. What an air filter cost?
All right. Carolyn calls up Sweetie to tell him to stay as far away from Clem as he can today because they're going to come down on him. Sweetie tries to call off the hit by calling Lonnie, but he's not answering his phone. So he leaves a message to call him back before he does the job. And that's going to go spectacularly wrong.
So where's the time? Because like, was there something significant in the fact that he, because Sweetie called him. We see him later at the park, look at his phone and like, see like, oh, okay. What the fuck happened? Why did he miss the phone call?
Oh, did Lonnie just not listen to the message? Did he see that there was a call?
It's just weird that they showed that he got something. He looked at his phone and got something. And then later on, he's like, oh, man, I missed your call. It was all over before I heard your voicemail. And I'm like, well, why did they show me the... He didn't miss it. He just chose to ignore it. Does that mean something? Hmm.
I don't think so. I think everything that happens with Lonnie here is played pretty straight.
So maybe you're supposed to understand that like these happen like simultaneously and he gets a phone call and it's just from and he's like, I just got, you know, I'm the guy's right there. Like, I got to go stab him.
Okay. Yeah, let me finish this and then I'll get back to this call or whatever.
Show's got me jumpy, man. I'm seeing shadows.
Yeah. I understand. The cops survey the park as Diane waits for the blackmailers. Lonnie shows up and he waits too. And then Clem finally shows up and makes contact with Diane. And Lonnie starts to make his move, but so do the cops at the exact same time. So he calls off the hit. Clem definitely scopes him, though. The cops grab Clem. They search him, but he doesn't have the gun or the book, so they have to just let him walk. Raylan is not happy.
Is it evidence that Mo's dirty that she jumped the gun here?
She does jump the gun, right? Like, I would not make a move if I were the lead on this until I see the fucking book.
Yeah. Or a gun comes out.
Or a gun. All right,
obviously. Just making a casual threat of, like, you think I'm afraid to hurt you in front of all these people? I don't know. Maybe you're a good cop and you care about the CIs and you would go. Because I guess that's the other thing. Is like, either the guy's got the gun in the book or he doesn't. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he showed up and asked for the money, you got the blackmail case. So you just need the actual item. And he didn't have it. So I don't know that she waits 5 minutes no, I guess if she kept waiting, that he'd eventually have to reveal a second location where they would do the deal. Original speculation that he was just going to take her money and then not give her shit and then try to hit her up again. Which,
then chase him through that whole process, right? Eventually, you would hope that, I mean, maybe Clem wouldn't. Maybe Clem would never give the book up. And he would just hitting her up for money.
Let me ask you this. So Clem gets up in Raylan's face and he's sizing him up and Raylan's still trying to do the job of a police officer and Clem's not having it. And at some point, Raylan kind of like steps back with the stunned look on his face and just kind of disassociates. Is this where he's having a realization of like no one's as lucky as you are?
I think so.
But he didn't know that he didn't have the book at this point. He's just
stunned that like Mo hadn't come up and said
no. This is the next. According to my notes, is that that happens? That happens next?
Huh. Maybe. I mean he. I don't know. I thought the time that I noticed he was stunned was when he realized that Clem was just going to walk on this. Huh, that they had nothing on him. So maybe it happens a couple times, but I mean that's devastating, right? Like Raylan thinks he's got him. He's juiced. He's spent all his juice here, you know.
Uh-huh. A lot of
I can't really do this DA trick again. Like even if the DA is down for it, Clem's not. So
I said, they're not going to have I don't think the Carolyn has enough information to infer everyone's identity. So it's not like they can keep going down the list. This was really a moonshot.
She's got that one name. Yeah.
I did like some of the dialogue, like how Raylan continued to like act dumb about what Clem, you know, Clem's like, let's, you know, you have as long as it's been since you've shot someone with that gun. And he's like, Oh, he says, I want to do a shootout with you. He's like, I don't think they got a range where you're going. He's like, oh, let's meet out in the streets. So mm-hmm. he's like, oh, I'll ask the chief, says if he thinks it's okay. It's just like...
That's great. They're definitely teasing the shootout. The thing is, like, so I've seen Raylan take down bigger game than Klim. Is
like
the
quick
thing
draw
when it comes
artists.
To a shootout. Yeah, I've seen. Like, I remember the Boone or whatever his name was from mm-hmm. Justified. He was a no shit quick draw artist. He was a guy who's probably at the range every weekend practicing his quick draw. I've seen Raylan, you know, get shot by him, but also blow holes in that dude. So
yeah,
I don't think
there's
a threat
trickery
in
involved with that though. But I think isn't that the one where he did the napkin pull?
The napkin pull? No, I'm talking about the very end of Justified where, like, they're just standing in the street, you know, feet away from each other.
I guess I maybe got Quarles, because Quarles is the guy who did the knife to the hand and then the hidden gun. Yeah. And Raylan had
the sleeve, right?
Yeah, yeah. And Raylan, when he went to go stab, he grabbed it with the towel and pulled it forward so the guy, and then he just, yeah.
Right,
but you're right. I don't think Raylan. There's nothing about Klim that says that he's a threat to Raylan if Raylan sees him coming.
Exactly. Yeah,
but if Klim goes to Florida and grabs Raylan's girl,
still on this Florida thing. I mean, I guess he's
they're
sure.
Bringing
take
back.
The garlic money and promise. Hey, we're going to the Bahamas. Start heading that way, right out to Florida.
Uh-huh.
I got to make a stop before we...
Just one stop, baby.
Yeah,
that's it.
Just one quick stop.
It's another girl we're picking up. You'll like her.
Yeah, there's possibilities there.
My only question is this
and
happen
we
next
episode?
Can
we get Winona back in the picture? I would love to see Winona in this series.
Yeah, I could see a little cameo, Winona cameo. I do think that my only question is, are they going to get Willa back next week or the save it all for the finale?
Man, you really, I mean, you can't take out Klim next episode, right? You gotta wait for the finale.
Well, I'm not saying that, like, I'm just saying, like, is it going to be a two-parter, him grabbing Willa, or is it going to be like
I can see him grabbing her at the end of the episode.
Ah, I see. And then, the classic the cliffhanger.
Uh-huh. And then stretch it out into episode 10 or sorry, episode 8 rather.
Gotcha.
I can see that happening. But I don't know. I've been so wrong about this show so many times. I don't know what it'll do. Who knows?
I do think that some evidence that Mo is a mole is how nonchalant she takes this crushing defeat.
Yeah. Like, aw, shucks, we didn't get him.
Like, even if you don't care about the Klim of it all, you're never going to be able to walk into another corrupt DA's office and threaten them with certain knowledge of a book that you don't even mm-hmm. think that's like a cop that wasn't on the tape would have taken this a little harder than they did, been a little more pissed at Raylan.
Mm-hmm.
You had me hang out my whole fucking career on a hunch or on some bullshit information you got dicking down the DA and she's just mm-hmm. like chin up, we'll get him.
Yeah, that's fishy as hell. Actually,
you'd think so.
Yeah. We'll see.
You're listening to the Justified Podcast. We'll be right back. Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com.
Sarah Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Howdy, Deputy. We're back with the Justified Podcast.
All right, so this is a scene we want to talk about earlier. Something about that sting is just bothering Raylan. It's how Clem seems to be getting so lucky so often, and he thinks it's fishy and asks Wendell his opinion, and Wendell asks him to change the subject. You know, he does not want to even consider the idea that there are... Well, okay, maybe that's what's going on. He doesn't want to consider the idea that there are dirty cops tipping off criminals. Does he not want to consider that or have a conversation about it because he is that dirty cop? That's one option. He refuses to believe that that's even possible, or it's so pervasive that he doesn't want to open that can of worms, and he knows it.
It feels like the latter, because I don't think, like, if there's corrupt cops in the force, I don't think Wendell would be stupid enough not to know it.
Yeah.
But the one I want to say is like the, when, cause so he shuts down hard, like you said, and he says, look, either way, whether this guy's super fucking lucky or we got a bent cop, I'm not interested in debating it. And I wouldn't know, which to me tells me that like, I'm not what there. Yeah. There's bent cops in this town, but I'm not one of them. But then Raylan looks at him real weird and he goes, okay then. And I'm not sure if that was Raylan being like, all right, you passed my lie detector, and now I know it's either Mo or Brill, or okay, then, like, that's the wrong answer you gave me.
The thing is, so I want to say maybe it's you passed the lie detector, and I actually might agree with you. Because what he does next is go straight to Carolyn. He doesn't go off on some mission to try and uncover the mole within the cops. He goes to Carolyn. So I wonder if he's connecting that dot, that there's some other back channel here that he has not sussed out and he wants explanations, damn it.
Well, it's possible that he just thinks that his relationship with Carolyn will get him better results. Like he can, sure. Yeah.
Like she might have this information as someone
or
who's
he might suspect
around.
Her that she betrayed him for her own purposes and he wants to suss that out too.
Yeah.
Like I said, he knows he's getting played. He just doesn't know who.
For sure. Yeah, so like I said, that night, Raylan drives out to Carolyn's house to get answers from her about the book, and she invites him inside this time. I want what you don't want to tell me, and if I can't get that from you, I really got no business being here. So he's sleeping with Carolyn just to get information on her client, because that's what that line says to me.
Implication is, or maybe like, there could be the thing of like, the jig is up, people have found out. So, like, we're, you know, like, if I can't be here in official capacity, then I can't be here.
That might make sense. Yeah. And things have so changed at this point for his understanding of stuff that.
Yeah.
He might be like looking to end this because it's just not proper.
It is an interesting juxtaposition because I think you're supposed to draw some conclusions from the beginning of the episode where she's doing this to him and it's very flirty and, you know, he's being very to where, like. I don't know what. Maybe this was supposed to be flirty. But I definitely got more of she's trying to placate him. She understands that he's upset and it, they're getting to the point where she's going to have to give up something.
I wonder if any of this connects to Jamal in a concrete way, like that fraud, you know, with their wilder and wilder stuff. There could be something very personal here that she has been keeping.
Damn, there's so many moving pieces. Even taking Sweetie off, I fucking forgot about Jamal.
Right? The Albanian Jamal, you kind of forget about it all.
Yeah, and that's like, yeah, it's like, oh, I don't know if they have time for the classic. Like, you know, Winona's husband, the real estate agent who, is like the anti-Raylan, and then you find out in season two he's taking money from the Dixie Mafia and almost gets himself killed. Like,
oh, Jesus.
It's another complication that Raylan and Carolyn don't need, but it's another fucking plotter and planner that thinks he's more clever than he is. So, yeah, that's another interesting possibility.
Yeah. I'm really curious to see. Hopefully we get to see a conversation between them, an honest conversation at some point. But we'll see.
Yeah, I hope it'd be nice to start the episode with Raylan and Carolyn's talk, honestly, the next one.
Right.
Because we don't get back to them.
We're in the final scene here, the big one. Lonnie shows up at Sweetie's bar to tell him that the meet was a setup and that the cops probably got Clem. But lo and behold, who walks in the door? None other than Clem himself. He shoots Lonnie in the head while he's on the phone with Bert, knowing that Sweetie set him up. Clem makes Sweetie listen to his cover of Seven Nation Army before shooting him in the heart and burning his bar to the ground. And this is, you know, where he makes him unplug the jukebox so they can hear the Seven Nation Army. The gun's not there because Trinnell moved it. And then the saddest part for me was when the bar is on fire and Trinnell like looks out the window and sees it. He comes running down, and it's so tragic because I'm not sure if he's registering this, but I am as a viewer. He had a significant hand in this by moving that gun, by just helping out where he can. You know, it's so ironic and so sad.
And the bar explodes. It knocks out a guy. I hope he's okay. He might be fucking dead.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big explosion, but it's not like it's not like a concussion.
That's true.
Concussion
I feel like
it's
that's
more
the
like
thing.
A
it's like
alcohol,
in real life,
explosion
that could kill you, like a shard of glass coming. You know,
sure.
But like in movie, in movie terms, that's not an explosion that kills you. Yeah,
probably not. No.
I mean, this is a great piece of dialogue. It's like it's the mirror image of the previous scene where like Sweetie's playing it sweet and just everything's super cool. Now the trap is sprung. It didn't get the Oklahoma Wild Man. So now he's back and the shoe's on the other foot. Is there any way Sweetie gets out of this alive without the gun?
I don't think so. No,
because there's this great line where he's like, even with a gun on you, you can't just lie to me and tell me I got a good voice. Like there's this like a little bit of respect, because I think if Sweeney just says, yeah, man, you sound great. So you're like twice as good as Jack White. He still gets his brains blown out.
Yeah,
Clem knows he sucks.
Yeah, he betrayed Clem. That's
why he won't even let
Sandy
listen to his tracks. Because Clem does suck, right? Like Clem doesn't make it on round one of American Idol.
Yeah, I mean he's not gonna make it through for being a great singer.
He doesn't make it to round one. He doesn't make it to the. He did Simon Cowell and Paula both pass on him because
it's a no dog.
Sitting there like, because you know usually he sang over and I'm like, okay, well that's not the worst I've ever heard. But when you just hear him isolated, it's pretty. I mean, this actor could be a good singer and he's intentionally. Sounding like shit.
It's not awful, but it's no Jack White. In comparison to Jack White, it's garbage, right? Like
I just like to here's the thing. Like if you cannot carry a tune, if you cannot stay, then you're not a good singer. And this guy's warbling all over the place.
Yeah, I agree. And there are better moments and worse moments. It depends, like, you know, what part of the song he's in, but
I don't know if people think of that, but I feel like that's a very hard song to sing because he's doing a lot of complicated falsetto and vibrato and weird phrasing and pitch changes and all this stuff. And
here's the other thing about a cover song. You gotta make a cover your own. And I think that's the most offensive thing to Sweetie. It's not that he can't sing, it's that he's trying to be Jack White. And just make it your own. Sweetie's cover of Seven Nation Army would be entirely different.
Oh, it would be badass.
I'm sure of it. So yeah, that's the most offensive thing to him. And here's the thing, like Clem, you can see in this moment, really looks up to him, really wants Sweetie's approval. And he's been so afraid to show him, you know, his work. because he knows how good Sweetie was.
Can I read a piece of feedback we got on the big old ears comment?
Yes, I saw this. Because
I think it really underlines this. This really helped me. So this is Justin wrote this in. He says, Miles Davis telling an up-and-coming jazz musician you got big ears after a jam session is basically engineered in a lab to be the highest possible compliment for the young jazz musician. He isn't telling he's the best player he's ever heard, saying that would mean Miles was bullshitting him. He's Miles fucking Davis. He was the best player he'd ever heard, and he wasn't shy about it. But he's saying that he was impressed with his ability to listen while he plays. Any musician of any genre that plays in any form or size of ensemble has to develop the ability to not just execute the mechanics of their instrument, but also be constantly listening to make sure that they stay in alignment with whatever the larger ensemble is doing with the piece. Jazz, and especially the late Miles Davis, goes everywhere or nowhere in any given moment, so you have to be completely tuned into or listening to every other musician. Any other genre, you got to listen to keep the rhythm tight in a group, but in jazz, they're listening to what themes and motifs the other players are developing and then leaning into their own improvisation into that. So the depths and importance of You Got Big Ears is basically saying, you got it, kid. You hear it. You can play at this level. Heart-stopping stuff for a young Sweetling. An extra note of context, a Sweetie mentions this was only a few weeks or months before Miles died, so the legend of Miles Davis was already in full bloom, and arguably in terms of worldwide recognition, he's still the world's biggest jazz star at the time when the world hadn't fully forgotten about jazz. So the weight of playing with him at that time is fully realized for young Sweetie. So what Clem is asking here is, you've got these golden ears, mm-hmm. blessed by Miles fucking Davis. Do I got it? Do I got what it takes? Mm-hmm. And
he says no.
You get the idea that maybe he's kept Sweetie around, like hoping that like he would round into musician, that like he would be, you know, he'd come up with the tape, the demo tape that he was ready for Sweetie to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of sad all the way around, right?
Yeah, it's...
They had the feeling of like Commodus strangling Marcus Aurelius and Gladiator.
Sure, yeah. Know? Yeah, absolutely. No, I feel bad for Clem on one hand, right? Because he does want to... He wants to be this thing that he's just unequipped to be. And he feels that and he knows it. And he's in those spheres, too. Like, hanging out with Sweetie must be a constant reminder of how bad he is at what he wants to do, right?
So yeah, he's just such a little boy in this scene.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, he's approval seeking, and like and the thing about this cover is it's such a fucking by the numbers cover.
Yeah,
that Sweetie thinks this is a joke, not just because he can't sing, but that he does not have the ears. He cannot hear what the essence of what Jack White is doing in that song is and make it
his own.
He's just mimicking somebody who's better than him, you know?
It's as far away as you can get from jazz.
Yes, exactly. And it all ties back even to, it's deeper in his persona, right? Because he looks at the things that other people have. He looks at Del Weems' condo or whatever this is, and he's like, I'm the king of the world, but he's sitting in a borrowed condo. The guy doesn't know he's there. He didn't earn any of this. He doesn't have what it takes to actually be the guy who has any of this stuff. He just kind of he's trying to get there, but he's not equipped to, you know. Every time he goes out and rams another car and has another blackmail victim jump off a ledge, he's proving that he doesn't have what it takes.
And then when he says, you know, close your eyes, I ain't gonna go out here in your honky chicken fat cover shit. The fact that the chicken fat came out, I think, was especially wounding. Like, that's the handpicked insult he had for Rayland, and now
love it.
The man that he worshipped musically is saying it to him.
Yeah, it's such a great scene. It's the culmination of this entire relationship in one scene, and in a tragic scene, because I don't want to see
Sweetie
die.
Clem's not happy. You can see as soon as he squeezes the trigger, he's like, God damn, I wish I hadn't have done that. I wish I could have that one back. At least that's how I thought it went.
Yeah, or just regretting that he had to do it.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know. But yeah, it's rough. Because Sweetie's gone, and I like Sweetie a lot.
Yeah, there's not there's a shortage of proper criminals in the city now.
Sure, the Albanians need to come back in force, man.
That's true. We need the Lal Garage and his family back.
The other thing I love about this scene is the way that this all came together with the gun. Because if you remember back to, it's like episode 3. It's been forever since Sweetie stashed this gun in the jukebox. And he's doing it in front of Trinnell. Trinnell sees the gun and he's like stashing it behind the jukebox. And he says, let him think he's got an ace in the hole. And we get to see the look on his face when he gets got. And this is the Elmore Leonard of it, right? This is, because I never expected it to come back this way. To be something bigger, something more like thought out by the characters. But here it is, just this dumb luck puts the gun in a different place.
True for himself, yeah.
And it turned out to be the exact opposite.
And Clint doesn't even appreciate it. Because I was rewatching these scenes where I was like, is this... Because I watched this episode multiple times. I missed both times the fact that Trinnell had the Walther P-38.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that Clem telling him to go unplug the jukebox was a massive flex.
Because he knew that he had already taken the gun.
Because he knew that he was going to go there and come up with his... nothing but his dick in his hands. Uh-huh. I think that Sweetie set him up and he didn't even appreciate it. He didn't even appreciate that how close to death he came.
Yeah. I almost feel like, I don't know if it's a lesser show that would have done this, a less confident show that would have done this, but you almost want a flashback in that moment. When Sweetie sees, like, feels around for the gun and it's not there, you almost want a flashback to him saying, let's see his face when he gets got, and then the flashback to Trinnell moving the gun and the tragedy of it all. Lesser show, but this show just lets you know all that. Just pick all that out of the scene, and it's great.
Almost 4 episodes ago. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, we had a lot of Chekhov's devices that we were worried about throughout the season, and this is one. So is the gun still important?
I don't know, because like any evidence that was on the gun is gone, right? Like it's in the bar.
Yeah,
it's burnt up, exploded. I don't think the Wrecking Crew stuff comes back on Clem now, even if they get the gun.
I was thinking, because Trinnell knows the significance of that gun. He didn't know about there's no way. There's no way those prints survive a bar fire.
Yeah, I don't think Clem's prints are going to be on that.
I don't think the gun survives, honestly.
Yeah, they won't link. I don't think they're going to link Clem to this. I don't know how they really would.
Yeah. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if some criminal forensics guy is like, yeah, I should be surprised to how much heat the barrel, the steel barrel of a gun can take, and you can get the ballistics. So I don't know. But I think that the show is telling us, with the bar being burnt down to the ground, that nothing in there is going to be able to be recovered.
What gun does Clem shoot Sweetie with?
That's a good fucking question. I don't
know.
It looked a lot like Raylan's. Like, I think he uses a SIG.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't that World War II replica.
Caliber.
Huh. I don't know.
Which is funny because it looks exactly like the gun that he described to Raylan as a limp dick, you know. But I wonder if he has gotten something very similar to his service carry, just as like a fixation thing.
Hmm. Yeah, maybe. Anyway, that's the episode, man. Good one.
All right, we got a couple. We already discussed some feedback. We got a couple other pieces. Justified@baldmove.com if you'd like to get your words in before the season's over. Scott says, not much speculation for me on the show, but again, a compliment on the writing. Much like the original Justified show did, this series manages to sprinkle original Leonard dialogue into the show, and it fits right in. In the diner scene in You Good, as Sweetie and Clem discuss potential marks, Sweetie dismisses the idea of running a scam on Roger Block because he probably has some hard bark on him. This references my favorite line of Leonard dialogue from the superb 1967 film Hombre, starring Paul Newman, where Richard Boone tells Newman, "Mister, you got some hard bark on you." I love that line. It's a testament to how this show that this line of dialogue fits right in. If you and your listeners haven't checked out Hombre, I'd encourage you to do so. It's basically pretty much a word-for-word rendition of Leonard's book of the same name. I don't know about you, but he kind of had me at Paul Newman, Elmore Leonard, crime. Uh-huh. Like, this sounds like I got to watch this weekend, dude.
Yeah, I'm on the IMDb right now. Paul Newman with long hair. Paul Newman plays multiple roles in this?
No.
Or... No, he's just one, but it must be different time periods. He's got short hair and long hair. I've never heard of this, which is shocking because I'm a big Paul Newman fan. I would watch this.
Says I'm now at the stage, though, that I'm nervously hoping this miniseries sticks to landing. The original show had one of the most satisfying endings to a great show I can think of, and I hope this does too. This miniseries, in fact, might be in the running for high risk, high reward at the Baldies this year. Oh, for sure. This is the definition.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do a 6-season run that everyone says, that's the perfect satisfying end for a real Justified fan, and then run back a miniseries and not have that jeopardize the legacy, which is that's the whole risk reward award in a nutshell.
Yeah, so totally.
But we'll see. And the other thing is, like, I think if this, I don't know if this is successful. If it is successful, I know that there's plans for more. And, like, you know, I thought the same way about Indiana Jones, like with the Crystal Skull, like, oh, they fucked it all up. And then I kind of think they redeemed it with the Dial of Destiny. So maybe we'll get the, but that's assuming Justified City Primeval doesn't give us another good exit on the lawman and his family. We already did Justin's with the big ears. Reginald says, in episode 6 Adios, we see a character keep her integrity despite being under extreme pressure, mostly based on the bad actions of others. While Carolyn Wilder is a tenacious defense attorney, she's no Saul Goodman. While tempted to do the wrong thing for the right reasons, she's no Walter White. Carolyn isn't going to use her bad fortune as an excuse to break bad. I was holding my breath, wondering what she's going to do, but Carolyn ended up being the good person I was hoping she was. While it's no shock, it's still a bit disturbing to see Sweetie get shot and killed. He was no saint, but he's no monster like Clement Mansell. If he did have to die, it was good to see Sweetie go out like he did. Ever since Kokomo, we've seen Sweetie become increasingly confident and exerting himself more. You telling me to hush? He snaps at Clement. The Sweetie from the first episode would never have been able to do that. So in the end, Sweetie stays true to himself. Like Mansell said, even with a gun on you, you can't lie to me and tell me you like it. Sweetie has too much respect for the music to give a fake compliment to that idiot.
Mm-hmm.
If Carolyn is not actually the big bad manipulating everything, I agree 100% with your analysis that she does, like, push right to the point, tries to do things the right way rather than doing things the wrong way. Do you think the death of Sweetie changes that calculus any?
Oh, it might. When she finds out about that, I think she's going to be probably heartbroken. I don't know her exact relationship with Sweetie, but they were close, so...
Does that, like, free her of any obligation to try to do things the right way if her mentor
It could. I mean, dies. It really depends on what kind of person you are, right? You can double down and be like, all right, well, I'm gonna double my efforts and get this person the right way and help the cops break maybe some of my oaths as a defense attorney. But, you know, she's already done that. Or you can, go off the books, off the beaten path.
Rank the following in terms of probability. Clem gets arrested and put away. Clem gets in a shootout with someone and dies. And Clem gets in a shootout with Raylan and dies. And Clem gets in a shootout with Raylan and Raylan dies. What's your probability for this?
Okay, so first and last are right out. No, there is no chance Clem goes to prison.
He's not fucking...
And he's not going to kill Raylan in a shootout.
That would be a kick in the dick. There's no way.
Going back to
poor Scott, that would besmirch the legacy. If Raylan fucking Givings gets killed by the Oklahoma Wild Man, I'll burn the Stetson 6X beaver felt hat that I don't own.
I'll buy one and burn it. Yeah,
that's true. It's exactly
$400 and all. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll set on fire while I'm drinking a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle and pissing on it. It would be unthinkable. I agree with that. So you think he's going to put him under?
It's, Yeah, it's the showdown. It's going to happen, and Raylan's going to win, and we're all going to cheer because we love Raylan.
Sometimes they subvert that. Like, you know, like Ava. Ava's the one that shoots Boyd, right? In season one? It's not Raylan after all the buildup.
Ooh.
That puts him in the hospital. Or maybe it is her. She shoots both of the Boyd brothers with a shotgun. But my point is, like, sometimes they'll set you up with you think it's one. And, like, I could see a real possibility of Carolyn doing it. Because they've teased that she has some guns. She can protect herself, at least in her. And I wonder if Clem will so underestimate her that she ends up plugging him in self-defense.
Okay. I could see that, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any chance he makes it out of the season alive. So, yeah, either one of them would be justified, I think.
What about, is it Shelly? Is that Clem's girlfriend?
Oh, Sandy. Yeah.
Sandy, goddamn it. Is Sandy kill Clem?
Oh, I really can't see it.
Is there anyone in the running besides Raylan, Carolyn, and I guess you don't like Sandy? Law Garage's people?
Yeah. Yeah, the Albanians could kind of get Raylan off the hook for needing to kill him. You know, just coming and do their thing. Because I'm telling you, the Albanians have to come back. I'll be really disappointed if they set that all up and did nothing with it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But they could be another complication that, you know, stymies Raylan again, right? It could be the meat, the sting all over again.
Heading into the penultimate episode, I feel like we're going to get less and less redirects and more direct action. Yeah. But we'll see. Do you have anything else?
No, I think that's it.
Justified at baldmove.com is how you send us feedback. If you'd like to find out all the other things we're doing, we're currently considering Foundation. We're about to get back to Daryl Dixon. Yeah. Believe it or not, The Walking Dead's still happening. We're going to do the Daryl Dixon spinoff. Goddamn, I'm always forgetting one other thing that's about to start. Loki, yes. And tons more stuff coming out this winter and next year. If you want to keep up with all that, follow us on any social media of your choice, at Bald Move, except for TikTok. We're Baldest Move there. You can also support us if you like what we're doing and you want more of it with zero ads. Go to support.baldmove.com and help keep us podcasting. That's going to be it for us this week. We will see you next time on Justified. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Adios.